And what happens as you get your mind focused in is you get to the point where you begin to see the separate thoughts starting to arise, exist, and pass away. Arise, exist, and pass away. Arise, exist, and pass away. And sometimes you only see the arising of thoughts. You see them all, everywhere you look, it comes into play. Those of you that have taken drugs may recognize that, that moment where it's what Christ said, and he says, look, I'm making all things new. It's like you're creating the universe. Everywhere you look, you see that you are creating stuff. You're not creating the thing. You are creating the form of it by your mind creating, going out and doing it. And you see the creation everywhere. That's the seeing the beginning of thoughts. Then there's another place where you're just focusing on the middle of thoughts, and it's like nothing ever is going to change. It's all static. Everything's stopped. Everywhere you look, it's stopped. It's like nothing's happening. It's all stopped. And then the third stage is where you see everything dying and decaying and falling away. And everywhere you look, it's decaying and dying, decaying and dying. And it gets, that's what it feels like. Tremendous despair and pain. Now, these are all stages, and they're articulated in the literature, and it's very standard stuff. And the teacher is a person who's been listening to human minds for 35 years, and he knows exactly what stage you're at when you walk in and say, this happened in my meditation. And he just sees a walking mind. I don't know what he sees, but I mean, that's what he's dealing with, is a walking mind. And he keeps moving you through. And Buddha describes, for example, the last 32 mind moments, trillion per blink of an eye, the last 32 before you go into the nibbanic state, which is the space between two thoughts. Because between two thoughts, there is no universe. What's called the void, or nibbana. And it's the ground on which all the forms and thoughts rest. It's the sky in which all the clouds are passing. And as you start to deal with that state in your being, you're finally doing what I started out talking about recognizing the part of you that is not conceptual, the part of you that is not informed. And look at what a circuitous route. Sitting in Burma, in the cell, bringing the mind, following the breath, getting the mind down to one point, sharpening it so it becomes like a laser, so it can go through, so it doesn't keep being at the whim of conceptual mind until you can get through, and you can go through until you get what's called the vipassana jnanas, or the insights that follow naturally. Because all the things that the Buddha teaches about suffering and the cause of suffering and the end of suffering, the things he teaches about anicca, or everything's changing, dukkha, that there is suffering, anatta, there's no self, all that stuff you can learn theoretically, conceptually, by reading philosophy books of Buddhism. Or, but what Buddha says is, don't read them, do it. You find out like I found out, because finally you're only free when you've experienced the stuff directly, not when you've just read about it. And I am finally driven to meditation. Not out of, oh my God, I've got to do it, but wow, look at this method and it'll work for me. I can do this. Now, the interesting thing, I should stop. I just want to say one more little thing here. That my primary method, as those of you that have read Miracle of Love know, my primary method is my relation to my guru. It's my love of my guru. Now, a lot in the West, that's a really weird thing to say, especially since he's dead. So I've got like an imaginary playmate in the Western image. It's like having a friend that is incredibly funny, incredibly wise, incredibly hip, a cosmic player, a rascal, who you hang out with all the time. And he's right here now. He's not here in an astral form sitting on the flowers. I just feel that quality of being in this moment. Now, I used to have him as an old man in a blanket. And after he died, I had the memory of him as an old man in a blanket. And I remember he said this, and then he said that, and then he pulled my beard, and then he did this. And I wrote a book about all the things he did and said when he was an old man in a blanket. But now he isn't an old man in a blanket anymore. He's that too. But he's just this presence. He's this quality of being. And what I found 12 years ago when I used to meditate is that after I huffed and puffed and followed my breath for 10 days or 20 days or 30 days, I'd end up feeling like I was distant from my guru and that my heart was scrunched and dry and I'd want a bhakti hit. I want to sing Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram, Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram, Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. And I just want to go back into the space of my love and my heart and the sweetness and the singing to God and the play and thinking of the little delights when I'd reach for his foot and he'd pull it back under the blanket and all the little diddly things about relationship. And I'd say, oh, whew, boy, was I dry. And now, 12, 15 years later, when I meditate, the quieter I get, the deeper my mind goes, the closer I am to him. Now we meet in the place. Now I'm meeting Shiva. Those of you that understand the Hindu tradition understand what I'm talking about. You meet the formless that's in form. You meet that part of yourself that has nothing to do with who you think you are, what you're sensing, thinking, remembering. It has nothing to do with growing old. It has nothing to do with being born or dying. There's no going, there's no coming. When Hakuin, the Zen poet, says, your going and coming is nowhere but where you are. I mean, I get on a plane in Hawaii, Honolulu, and I end up in San Francisco. And then I'll get on a plane in a couple of days, and I'll go to Boston. And then I go on a plane, and I go to Nepal, and I go, where am I going? Plane is flying and flying and flying. It's doing its thing. And I'm right here. And I'm here, and now I'm here, and now I'm here, and now I'm here. If I'm busy defining myself as somebody that's coming and going, it's exhausting. But there is nowhere to go. It's like Ramana Maharshi when he's dying and all his devotees say, don't leave us, don't leave us. He says, don't be silly. Where can I go? I mean, I'm only dying. It's no big deal. I'm just dropping my body. The minute you recognize that part of your being that isn't in time and space, Swami Ram Tirth says, I am without form, without limit, beyond space, beyond time. I am in everything, everything is in me. Now that all sounds, from a logical, analytic point of view, like absolutely that guy should be locked up. From a mystical point of view, that's a beautiful expression of who we are, much more than who we thought we are. So, what we're facing here when we come together in consciousness studies, and we come together to consider the issues of relationship, of nuclear holocaust, of what we're going to do in the world and all, is that in the terms of keeping our eye on the mark, we do what we must do in the world. But we don't forget that it is all an exercise to awaken out of the illusion created by our own mind, because the more we are free of the illusion in our own mind, the less we will suck other people into the illusion. And if you really want to end suffering, the way to end suffering is end your own suffering, and the way to end your own suffering is to extricate yourself from the illusion of your own mind, created by your own mind. And once you are free of that, then you have a chance to free another person. When I sit with that person, that fellow this afternoon with AIDS, I am working on myself to keep myself spacious and present and clear and not get caught in the heavy melodrama of a beautiful young man dying. And if I can do that and just see the unfolding of law and keep my heart open and love and be with just what is, I can be an instrument, as happened this afternoon, of the release of his suffering, although for a moment. So that when people said, well, the 70s was the me generation, they don't understand that that was as direct a route to compassionate action as there could be, because much of the action that was done, and this is my dialogue with Dan Ellsberg, that much of my dialogue, much of the issue about social action is, very often, I mean, I don't know whether I said it in that, because I wasn't watching all of it, and I don't quite remember what was edited into the film. But what I said, what I know is that the way in which we dealt with the Vietnam War put Reagan in the White House. Now, Reagan's a good president in certain ways and a horrible president in others, and we don't have to do a political thing, but I can, what I'm saying is there is a pendulum swing that when you do things in a certain attached way, you create the polar, you give juice to the whole polarity all the time. And what we have developed is, in this me generation and all these years, is a certain sophistication. I hope that consciousness studies, the work on oneself, to become an instrument for the relief of suffering, so you've got to do it on all levels at once. I'm now chairman of the board of the SAVA Foundation. Yesterday I was at the board meeting. I just finished the board, the week-long board meeting. We just gave away, I don't know, $600,000 for blindness in Nepal and blindness in India and reforestation in Africa and Costa Rica and trades, crafts for the Guatemalan refugees and health clinics for the American Indians. And it's incredible. I mean, it's just for me to realize that I just went to Nepal as the chairman of the board of the SAVA Foundation on a fact-finding mission and to inspire the whole thing and to see what's going on and to meet with the government officials about getting policies, in fact, in place that would do more cataract operations per year. And I put on my blue blazer and my necktie, and I am the chairman of the board. And I think at some point, what am I doing? I mean, you know, a few years ago I was in a dress, and here I am in a tie and a jacket going over, and how do you do? And people see me coming as an NGO director, I mean, the non-governmental organization. We have a contract with the king of Nepal. We're like the Red Cross or something like that. We're a real thing. I'm the chairman of the board. You know what? If the chairman of the board of the Red Cross, we're building a hospital in Nepal. We've got jeeps and offices and people examining eyes and doctors doing surgery that we're importing from here and there. It's like a big production. And the chairman of the board is coming. You got the image? I mean, if you are a Nepali official, how do you do? And I thought, gee, if I can lose the spirit, this is when I'm going to lose it. Because they're going to take me seriously. And they are not the kind that I can tell, hey, you know, I'm really not the chairman of the board. I'm just appearing to be the chairman of the board. I mean, now that there are no adults here, we can really play. You know, I mean, I can't quite say that, you see. And I found out I didn't have to. I could just look into their eyes, and we could talk about stuff, and I could disagree with them, and I just loved them so much that pretty soon it all just turned into, I don't know what. It was like satsang. It was like having darshan of spiritual beings all the time. I came back from that trip higher than I went. And it was a great teaching to me. What I'm trying to learn now, and I'm studying, and I hope to write about it and talk about it and just keep analyzing how to do it, is to enunciate karma yoga much more effectively in our society. That is the yoga of doing what you do and doing it in a way of becoming free. Because when I left Rangoon last summer, I was in a very delicate state of mind. The telegram came, my stepmother had cancer, I had to come home. I came home and I decided to throw myself into service because my guru had said, when I said, how do I get enlightened, he said, feed people. How do I know God? Serve people. I decided, all right, I'm just going to throw myself in totally to feeding and serving people. Everybody that calls upon me, I'm going to say yes. I physically don't have any more space. 7 days a week, all the time. My father, AIDS patients, SAVA, fundraising, therapy cases, working with the aged, we're dot, 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 sure, yes, of course, oh, yes, you'd like me to write this, of course, yes, yes, of course. Till every minute of every day, from the minute I wake up till I go to bed, just more of it. Going to burn out, why? What burns out? That's the interesting one. Do you have to burn out? Why can't you get juiced from it? You don't burn out from meditation, why should you burn out from karma yoga? You only burn out when your mind has expectations and models. That's what burns out. If you don't have any model, what's to burn? Only models burn. Far out. So all year I thought, well, I'll see if it'll work. I'm not even going to meditate. I'm not going to contaminate it. I'm going to do it as a pure yoga. By the spring, I was like, I can make it through to the next meditation course. I think I'm losing it. What do you mean you want me to do something? Don't you know I'm busy? I was really losing it, you know. Oh, damn it. I got to go to that meeting. And I went back to sit with this teacher just last week or 2 weeks ago. And I was full of, I'm going to face a teacher for whom meditation is the thing in life. I'm one of his students, and I spent a whole year and I haven't meditated. I mean, you talk about guilt. You know, it's not guilt. It's just figuring how I can cover it, you know. See, but you're under a vow of truth, so you can't quite do it, see. So I got to go in, and I figure, oh, boy, I'm back at square one, and I sit down and meditate. Within one day, I am right back where I was at the edge when I left Burma the year before. And I think, gee, it's working. It's beginning to work. It'll work. It's much harder to stay high when you're in the marketplace. But when you really get to a certain point where that's, you only want to be free, you use the marketplace to get free. Kabir says, Kabir or Rumi, Kabir says, I go into the marketplace, but I'm not a purchaser. I don't want to buy anything. You want power, you want sex, you want money. Sure, it's all right to want them, but are you attached to the wanting of them? You attached to the getting of them? Therein lies burnout. You do what you do, what happens, happens, no burnout. But that is another topic for another time. Thank you, that's good. I mean, I think I covered a lot of territory thus far. You want to stretch for a couple of minutes and then let's do some questions and answers? Is that okay? Or discussion? Is that all right, Joseph? Here we go.
Excuse me. What about the announcements? The white Malibu, TKF 334, your lights are on.
I saw that person come. I'm not sure they're part of this group. I tried to find that person before, and then I decided they weren't part of this group, but I may be wrong. Okay. Are we ready? Here we go. We don't seem to have a Joseph. Where is he? Wouldn't you do better at being in the middle somewhere?
Maybe, yeah. John, where should Don be with that? Can people on this side of the house be picked up by him?
I'll repeat the questions too. That'll help.
Thank you. And should people stand to ask their questions?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, so if everybody would stand to ask the questions, that would be really helpful.
Okay. This is the part of the evening that is called the answer man, which we make believe you have questions and we make believe I have answers, knowing full well that we all know the answers and we all know the questions, and we've been asking them in the cave for thousands of years until we're done. Questions? Yes.
Which doesn't seem nearly as helpful at times. And I wondered what your thoughts were about the interplay of those two aspects.
It's the same. Did you all hear the question?
Yes.
Was that get on? Do I have to repeat that, or is that all right? Okay. It's the same question of what is the relation between the intellect and the intuitive listening heart-mind. Thing called the heart-mind, heart-mind, is that all the theoretical structure you learn and you feed in, and you feed it in as deeply as you can, and then when you are in the situation, you empty and listen, and to the extent that that stuff is real and valid in the situation, it will, if you trust it, it will arise and guide the way you respond. You won't forget it all. You don't have to keep it in mind. The problem with having a theory is that oftentimes it comes between you and the person. Like somebody walks in and you say schizophrenic. You don't see another being like yourself. You immediately categorize and label in order to be efficient, you think. But in that efficiency, you lose the connection between you and the being. And that quality of heart merging that happens from emptiness is, that's where compassion is that heals. So that you learn the stuff and learn it and then trust that it's in there and walk in empty, and then it will arise as it's appropriate. I mean, I was a psychotherapist and learned all that stuff, and I haven't studied it for 25 years, and it's of course changed in some ways and not in others, but I notice that when I sit down with somebody and I listen, what comes out is some kind of amalgam of old psychotherapy and spiritual perspectives, and it all keeps coming out in new forms and new ways, because what is in there is really in there. And I trust it now. I don't have to rehearse it and think about what psychosexual stage of development this person is in, or, you know, what kind of ego weaknesses and strengths. I don't have to rehearse it because it's there and it will arise. So it all has to do with how ripe you are to learn something and how intuitively valid it ultimately is. Is that, it's a very delicate balancing, you know? Questions, yes?
I have a problem between this concept of letting go and also being exactly where I am, especially when I'm in a space that I don't like. I'd like you to say something about that, please.
Say a little more what you mean by letting go.
Well, when choosing to let go of an attachment, for instance, or just being exactly where I am with the attachment.
Now I'm hearing it. All right. Attachment, letting go of the attachment, or... See, the first stage is honoring what you are. I'm a human, there are attachments, and it hurts. That's the first thing. Opening to what is, not what you wish were. You wish you weren't attached, but you are. Right? That's the first stage of it. It's a funny thing, you can't give up attachments like that, because as you try to push something away, it sticks to you. You're busy giving up attachment. Like, I'm not going to be attached, which is an attachment. But what happens is, you do it obliquely. You honor what is, and then you kind of deepen the understanding of yourself as something else through your study, through your meditations, through your spiritual practices, and then slowly the attachments fall away like the skin of a snake. It falls away. And what you do is you turn and face the attachment and examine it. And you look for that little thread of awareness in you that isn't attached. It's always there. There's always a little thread that's just noticing the attachment, saying, boy, look how attached I am. That part of it isn't attached. That's just noticing. All the rest of you, 99% is attached. Don't leave me, don't leave me. And 1% is saying, Boy, look at that attachment. And you cultivate that little thread. If you try to deny the attachment, that's a defense mechanism. That doesn't work. So don't confuse non-attachment with dissociation or that kind of defense of detachment that's pushing away something. You honor that this is part. I mean, I honor that I have desires. The question is, do I identify fully with those desires or not? It doesn't mean I don't have the desires. When somebody they love dies, they experience grief. That's a human condition. At the same moment, you can cultivate the equanimity of mind that allows you to have perspective about the grief. It doesn't mean the grief isn't there. There's a monk whose son has died, and I mean, I think Stephen Levine uses the example, and somebody, I think I actually used it in How Can I Help? And somebody comes and says, why are you crying? You're such a high, wise monk. And he says, well, everything is illusion, and the death of a child is the greatest illusion. And it's just an illusion, and it hurts. And you don't make believe you're not human. You don't get holy by making believe. You allow yourself, you look at it, and then you cultivate that little part of you that is also there. Besides the attachment, there's another part of you that hears me perfectly clearly. Yes? I will repeat the questions, yes.
I have really two questions. One is, can an undisciplined person get into the state? And it seems to me you're required to just be consistent in moving along in a certain direction so that if you approach this on a 5-minute stage and meditate once every 6 weeks or go about it as most of us do a lot of hobbies, we're not going to make it. Do you agree with that?
The question is, if you don't have much discipline, can you proceed spiritually if you're just doing it as a kind of a hit or miss or now and then kind of operation? There isn't any route through to freedom. You might hear what I'm saying and be so ripe that in a moment you're way ahead of me. There isn't a rule. You don't have to go through 9 steps and everybody has to go through the 9 steps. That's nonsense. I mean, there are stories of saints like Ramana Maharshi. He was a 17-year-old kid. He wasn't even a spiritual kid. And suddenly he just had this experience that felt he was dying, and he said, okay, I'll die, and he just went into another state and he was free. I mean, so that it has to do with your karma. It's not necessarily how much gung-ho meditation you do. I'm merely describing a method. It is not the method. It is a method, although the people who teach it think it's the method. People always do, but it's just a method. Second question. Yeah, are the gurus dying out? I hear the question. Oh, it's a very valid question. I have a feeling it's a little like the Bhagavad Gita when Krishna says that I embody myself from time to time as is needed. And that as long as there is need for such beings, that need will force the creation or the bringing down of such beings. And that from my understanding of an evolutionary process, there are beings just entering the pool of separate entities, and there are beings that are nearly done, and they keep coming by. So I think there's going to be a continuous supply. The question of whether or not the culture will support the noticing of them. See, that's the interesting thing. I mean, when you live in the villages I live in India, they live in the world where there are gurus. I mean, the family I live in has had 4 different gurus in the course of all of their lifetimes. And they were all like my guru. They were all incredibly high beings. And I look and I'm jealous, but the culture there supported those beings being recognized, honored, realized. Here, if somebody's a guru, I mean, there's, you know, but what do you do for a living? You know, it doesn't... Not supported. Yes.
Good evening.
Good evening. It is. Yes.
I'm playing with the idea of no expectations, particularly letting go of expectations of the planet being saved. And to follow along the lines that you've been speaking, when my meditation teacher announces there's 1 minute left in meditation, it intensifies my mindfulness and my awareness of my breath, of what's present. And I wonder, what are your thoughts about what is the breath or the pulse of the planet that I can put my awareness on, since I've been told, and I believe perhaps, that there's 1 minute, 1 hour, 1 year left?
I think that right effort, because that question come through all right? Yes?
Yes.
Okay. I think that right effort is very important, and that thought is very powerful, and that it is certainly possible to affect the universe through thought. And Christ said, had ye faith, you could move mountains. And I think that's true. You could do it with your thought. I mean, I'm talking about literally. I'm not talking figuratively. The question is, how do you cultivate the kind of power of thought that actually changes something? And from my understanding, that thought is cultivated, as I was telling Dan in the videotape, by being so at peace with what is, that you are thinking about the peace of the planet and the release of paranoia and fear in the culture. But you are doing it from such a quiet, present place that there is not flickeriness in your mind that's created by your own fear about it ending, or your own loss of equanimity into urgency, into I got to do something about this. I mean, I think you would, hearing what you're saying, you would meditate in the sense of sending out that kind of thought form to create peace and presence and clarity and consciousness in decision making, and surround public officials with those kind of thoughts and do all that with your mind. And you would do it because that's what you do, because you have heard what your dharma is, which is a very clear concept about doing what is appropriate for you to do to honor your incarnation. And your incarnation is a member of an ecosphere and a member of a nation state and a member of a world culture and a member of a surviving species, and it all those have responsibilities in them. And you don't do them out of ought or should or heavy or my God, what may happen. You do it because that's what you do. For years, I thought when my brother says to me, aren't you great to be taking care of Dad? He's seeing it as some kind of thing that has to be done. I'm not experiencing it from that place. I'm seeing it as that's what I do. Perfectly light, just like I breathe and I take care of Dad. And I would make a statement about anti-nuclear consciousness and make a statement about the American Indians at the Four Corners and so on. And I feel just a part of the universe and an appropriateness of response. But it's coming from a very quiet presence, so that my vibration that I'm putting into the universe is feeding exactly the thing I'm trying to bring about. Because to the extent that I act out of fear, I am reinforcing the fear out of which the bomb is being built.
Isn't it a thought of peace and expectation?
No, it's... See, the... You do it because you're doing it. Like I am, there's a story of the rabbi who every morning came out of his house, and he walked across in this little Polish village. He walked across or Russian village. He walked across the court, the square, the village square, to the shul, to daven, to prayer. And he'd done that for 20 years. And one morning, you know the story, one morning the Cossack's coming by and he says, "Good morning, Rabbi, where are you going?" And the rabbi says, "God only knows." And the Cossack figures, what kind of a wise guy is this? He shouldn't say that, I'm a Cossack. And he arrests him. And he throws him into prison for being flip. And the wife of the rabbi comes and says, "What did you do? What did you do?" He says, "I just said, who knows? God only knows. I didn't know I was going to end up in prison." Okay. Yet he was walking to shul, but without expectation, because he walks to shul. And you end up doing, I'm doing what I'm doing now. What happens to you is what happens to you. I'm doing this because this is what I do. And this is appropriate for me to do at this moment. Can you see what I'm saying? And it's appropriate for us to bless and to bring peace and to become, as Sri Aurobindo talks about, conduits of spirit coming to earth. It's appropriate for us to keep purifying and allowing that thing to come through us. What happens is what happens. Is that dealing with the question? In relation to that, there is the Big Mountain Sundance, which is, these are critical times for the American Indians, as you know. And on July 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, and 6th, there are going to be some prayers and meditation vigils. And all they're asking is that 30-minute prayer and meditation at the time that the sacred tree of life is raised in the center of the arbor, making the beginning of the Sundance. And just to help, this is a very critical year, and if you can use your thoughts and your heart to help in this Sundance to try to clarify things a little bit before the Indians are taken from their homes, you might do that. I'm going to leave this right here, and if you would like to copy down the times and the hours, feel free to do so. And would you leave it so I can take it with me, because I'd like to remember and do it myself. Okay. Yes, questions? No questions. About anything. You have to be wise. We can shift levels. Sir.
I'm asking about cause and effect. And is it a reality? Like, you know, you're thinking, well, things are. Do you think about causes? I mean, you know, effects. What happens if something happens? Does it come to you just what caused it? By just being there with it?
Well, in the universe, is that question come through all right? Okay. In the universe of forms, everything is related to everything else in a cause and effect way. Yes. That is true of forms. When you get out of form, that all turns into a dream. Now, the question of whether you think about it or not is often a way of getting caught back in your mind to think about why did this happen, rather than just allowing being with what is. When you if you look at like Buddha's law of dependent origination, you see that birth is caused by the clinging of mind, and then birth leads to this, and leads to this, and leads to this, and there's about 11 or 12 steps, and it's all a series of cause and effect. The secret of cause and effect in our human creating karma is that if I do an act, if I am attached to what I'm doing at this moment, attached to what's going to happen with it, attached to the fruits of it, I start a create a condition that I'm going to get caught in later. If I have no attachment to that, as I extricate myself from being identified with what I'm doing, it's just doing, then there is no karma for me in this act. This act is just it's old karma running off without my creating new karma. There's a very fine distinction of whether, if you're identifying with your action, you create more karma. If I think I'm doing something, I create karma. And then it is a cause for a subsequent effect. So in a sense, yes, it is all cause and effect. From a certain place of looking, if you stand outside of time, it's all simultaneous. And it only seems sequential from where you're standing. You hear that one, too?
Yeah, you're looking at the
eliminate the form.
Yeah, exactly. So cause and effect is still a relative term. And as is getting interesting in science, as they see the reverse way in which effect becomes cause for the cause which becomes effect. I mean, it starts to go backwards in time. That's what now the leading edge of science plays with. That'll really boggle the mind. Questions?
There are many of us here, I know, that are involved in the Course of Miracles, Garofa. There are various things that are going on that are absolutely elevating. And sometimes I wonder if this is something that one should continue on and on in, perhaps repeating and constantly reaffirming these things, or whether it is better just to read, to get what you can, and then let go of it and know that it will be of benefit as you live, rather than studying and studying and studying.
I hear. Did that question come through all right? I gotta get feedback each time. Yes? Oh, all right, thank you. It depends on whether or not that particular form of yoga is your method, your primary method. If it is your method, like I, for example, I was working with the Bhagavad Gita, which is 18 chapters. I studied it for 5 years, every day. Every day I would read one chapter. When I got to the 18th, I'd start again. Every morning I read a chapter for 5 years. And I began to feel I was beginning to understand the beginning of it, all right? I mean, it just keeps opening up and opening up and opening up. And so if it is a method for you, you can keep doing it and coming back at deeper levels and deeper levels and deeper levels until you become it. Then you're done with it, all right? On the other hand, if it is not your method, you can pick it up. Whatever you're ripe to hear, you are, and then you can put it away. Maybe come at it some other time. See, then it's not your primary method. But if it's your primary method, just keep staying with it and staying with it and keep staying with it and staying with it. Is that dealing with the question?
That's fine. How do you know?
I think you learn to trust that intuitive place in you. And for example, sometimes when you're bored, you sense that you're bored because there's a defense in you that you'd like to break through and you'd like to go through the boredom. At other times, the boredom says, enough of this. And only you know that. And how do you know? You don't know you know, but there is an intuitive place and you've got to learn to trust that. And that takes some, because there's no external measuring thing. You can say, oh, this is that kind of boredom and this is that kind of boredom. And so you get to trust. And this is very scary stuff because you're in an uncharted realm in which you have a unique upaya. You have your method. And it's not anybody else's. And you've got to listen. And for you, this is right on. And for you at another time, I go and sometimes somebody says, would you like to meet so? Oh, I'd love to meet them. And another time they might say, would you like? No, I'm sorry. I really don't. And I trust that. I have learned to trust that more and more. And I'll pick up a book and read a paragraph and put it down. And other books, I study and study and underline and write and read. And I have no rational reason for that. I can't give you a reason. I just trust that there's something in me that is homing, a homing device that's picking up what I need to use. And a lot of people accuse me of being a rather sloppy, dilettante, and eclectic. And I honor the charge, but that's my route. What am I going to do? I can't be a phony about it. That's the way I'm working. I've got another one to add into the stew of Ramtha and Seth and all, which is Emmanuel. And we now have Emmanuel's book, which I wrote a long preface for. And Emmanuel is an absolutely delightful addition, much lighter than most of the others and kind of playful and just kind of fun. And Emmanuel's book is just, we've been published, we printed, no publisher would print it. So we gathered the money together and we printed it ourselves. And now, after 3 printings, it's just being taken over by Bantam, so it will be. Emmanuel will be everywhere, and another spook comes to light. It's great having these friends that don't have bodies because they really lighten your hold of this whole thing of being embodied. But as I warn people, just because somebody doesn't have a body, don't think they're wise. I mean, see, you kind of think they're wise because you don't know how to not have a body, but there are more beings that don't have bodies than do have bodies, and there are a lot of Meshuggah beings that don't have bodies, so trust your heart as to whether or not they are wisdom or they're not wisdom. Okay. Questions? Sir?
I'm interested in more of your thoughts on karma yoga, and particularly how to maintain your center and your awareness in the midst of staff meetings or meeting the king of Nepal or whatever you're doing.
More thoughts about karma yoga and how you sort of keep your center through it all. There are dozens, it's composed of dozens of little devices, some of which work some of the time and don't work other times. For example, mantra with certain tasks works beautifully. Like having doing japa with mala beads sometimes works beautifully. Like when you're driving, sometimes you can do japa, and it just keeps bringing you back, flicking you. You're busy driving, and suddenly you're in traffic, and then you flick to Ram, and then suddenly you're out of it. You go back in, come out, and go back in, come out. Singing is another way. I mean, I do a thing called the Hanuman Chalisa, which is 40 verses in praise of Hanuman. Sounds like I won't do it all, but it's Shri Guru Charana Saroja Raja Nijamanu Mukuru Sudari Barano Ragubara Bimala Jasu Jodayaku Falachari Budi Hinatanu Janike Sumaron Pawana Kumara Balabudi Vidya Dehu Mohin Haru Kalesha Pitara Siyawara Ram Chandra Paraje Sharana. Then it goes on for about 5 or 6 minutes. Some days we do 108 of them, which takes about 16 hours. And now I do that when I'm driving often. And it'll just keep moving me out all the time while I'm doing it. But I was talking to a fellow yesterday who's a very dear friend who used to be in the temple in India, and he's now a Superior Court judge in Alaska. And he said, when I'm sitting on the bench and listening to a murder case or a rape case, and I've got to be thinking to watch for the little slip of thought all the time, I can't do japa. I can't let my mind flick even that much. I've got to stay that conscious in. And I said, well, just take a little picture or a little word and put it down on the desk, and every now and then your mind will just float by it, and it'll just sort of remember a little bit, just for a second, then you go back. And you can just do it little bits, little bits, little bits, little bits. Then there are ways of taking exercises, of taking the people you go, like you walk into a meeting. It's the one I talk of, the story I tell about the state trooper, which I won't tell tonight, but the one about you go into a bank and there's a bank teller. You go up to draw a check. Now, who are you seeing? Are you seeing a bank teller, and are you somebody drawing a check? Or are you seeing the Divine Mother that's about to dispense? Is this Durga that's about to give riches to you? You know, I mean, which myth are you going to pump up? Which is real? And you get to so that you practice with people, looking through the veil of the models you had in your mind. And I'm constantly doing that. You sit in a meeting, and you look around, and you've got all these old models of who everybody is. And then just kind of flick at them. Like sometimes you walk into a meeting, and it is somebody of your sexual predispositions are such that you might be attracted to that person. So you meet them, and you are aroused. And so you see them as woman or man. Maybe this person is your barber. Now, do you see them as your barber, or do you see them as woman or man? Now, if you weren't sexually attracted, you'd see them as barber. But you are sexually attracted, you see them as woman or man. Now, the game is you start to play with that. And you start to play with, and that, and that, and that. If you practice, like if you work with another person and you look at the point between their eyes as a meditation and just sit looking at the point between somebody else's eyes, just about this far apart, and just sit there looking, right at the point between the eyes, and just rest on it like a meditation. It's not a social, you're not saying, hello, are you there? I'm here, I love you, I have power over you. You're not using your eyes, you're just focusing and meditating. You'll see the face keep changing. It'll start to change after a while. It gets very liquid, the whole process, and you start to see an ancient being, a new being, lust incarnate, greed, fear, loneliness, you see sadness, you see shadows, you see youth, you see hope, you see innocence, you see almost everybody in the universe all the time. And you start to practice loosening the hold of the models of your mind. You start to play with stuff. It's like turning it all into silly putty. But you don't do it in such a way that when they say, well, what do you think about this proposal? You say, what, you know, I mean, see, you got to stay in tight enough so that you don't lose it when you're doing it. But you can play a little bit. Like, it gets so now that when I look at somebody for more than a few seconds, they turn into you wouldn't believe. But I don't any longer go, or, you know, like that. I mean, I just can look at them, oh, yes, hello, how do you do, you know, and it's like shaking hands with a crocodile, you know, and okay, fine, great. Now, the other thing is that when you wake up in the morning, often you can just sit for a few minutes and run through your past day and get yourself into a little quiet state and maybe take some holy books you keep around, books that are constantly reminding you that it isn't as it seems, and you read one little shloka or one little paragraph or something like that. You just read it and reflect about the day that's coming up and think about it in those terms and then go and do the day. And then at the end of the day, you might stand a few minutes and see how many times you lost it along the way. And then you can start to notice what it was that caused you to lose it. And you'll begin to notice patterns that I was doing, like Uspensky describes, he was a student of Gurdjieff, and he describes how he decided to self-remember. He was going to stay very conscious. And he was saying, Uspensky is walking down the street. Uspensky is turning left. Uspensky is walking down the street. Uspensky is hitting his cane on the pavement. And suddenly he saw his tobacconist shop, and he remembered he needed cigarettes. 2 days later, he remembered he had been doing an experiment. Okay? It's, oh, yeah, I need tobacco. Right, okay, good morning, how are you? Yes, 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 and he forgot completely. 2 days later, he remembered it. Now, after a while, you begin to see what it is that gets you each time. You're doing fine until, well, let's talk about your salary. And suddenly you go unconscious, okay? Or lust, or whatever it is that takes you. And after a while, you get to notice those things that take you away. And so you start to use your daily life as like a little experimental practice where you're playing with the stuff of life, seeing what puts you to sleep, using little devices to awaken you, to remember, studying. Am I dealing with the question? Yeah. And often you can find somebody else that is willing to play the game with you, if you're lucky, in your workplace, and then you can collaborate and you can say, I'll make a deal with you, I'll help you awaken if you'll help me. And you enter into a contract to remind each other. Now, it's tricky because when you go to sleep, the usual thing is you don't want to be awakened. Somebody goes away and says, hey, like Stephen Levine and I have that contract, and sometimes I'll call up and Stephen will say, we're in the conversation, and he'll call me, and we'll be talking. He'll say, how's your heart? Which means, you're losing it, baby. And I'll say, my heart's fine. What do you mean, how's my heart? Like, you stupid ass, my heart's fine. What are you talking about? Well, how's your heart? You know, but I've gotten so that I trust him so much now that when he says, how's your heart, I just kind of, well, wow. I mean, my first thing is, oh, God, he's got me, you know, what's wrong with my heart? And then the next thing is, let me listen. Oh, boy, yeah, I got so busy with efficiency, and I got to tell you about, you know, stuff. And then I cool down. And you get so that you trust people to help you. But it doesn't mean that they know. They may be stuck and trying to help you out when they can't, and that's why three is better than two. See? I mean, there are things that will help you awaken. A holy book sometimes helps you, or as we found out in Christian fundamentalism, a holy book can put you to sleep, too. And a spiritual teacher can help you awaken, but often the way you relate to them can be asleep in a kind of hysterical devotional quality. And friends, I mean, all these things can help you or they can be traps. Every method is a trap, and every method can help you. And you've got to keep very alert to how you're using methods all the time. Not heavy, just alert. Play with them. Questions? BJ.
This is all getting so joyful. I hate to bring it back to the world situation.
Bring it back.
In your dialogue with Daniel Ellsberg, you touched on the idea that perhaps our leaders are acting out, you know, the hatred and the negativity.
Of all of us.
Of all of us. And yeah. I'd like you to talk some more about that and about what's really going on now. Isn't polarization really happening now more than ever? I was at a meeting with Joanna Macy recently, and when she gives workshops, they do house calls. And these people were talking about how much hatred for Russia and fear of Russian people they discovered. And I saw a newspaper today inside a box where you put a quarter, and I didn't buy it, but I just peeked at what it said, and it said the American Science Foundation had done a survey, and they said 50% of the people in this country had no concept of science at all. They didn't believe in evolution. They didn't know what radiation was. They didn't know what DNA was. Da-da-da-da.
They may be the lucky one.
So where's, you know, we they? I mean, all of us are into Course in Miracles and Love and Light and sending peace and being in, you know, these wonderful gatherings and downlinks and stuff. And, you know, what's happening?
Well, BJ, is your assumption somehow is the world is only a useful place for incarnates to do their work if somehow it were all conscious and perfect. But the fact is, it is what it is, and there are beings at every stage of evolution. You may walk down the street, and the first person you see is somebody that is very Neanderthal-like. This is the first time they came into a human form of the billions of times humans come. And the next person you meet may be an old saint who just dropped by to bless us. You know, and in between are all the permutations. And the people that end up politicians aren't, and necessarily, the criteria for selection doesn't necessarily mean that you're getting the most conscious element. And the nature of what of who we are on Earth is that we have certain attachments that are, Buddha calls them the five hindrances of lust, greed, hatred, ill will, agitation, sloth, and torpor, and doubt. And if you, lust and greed are one, so in case you count and came to six, that's why it's only five. And then there's the 10 fetters and the 22, it goes on and on. But there are these things that are the qualities of attachments of mind that is what leads to incarnation. And when you understand who we are that incarnated, I'm not surprised at all that we are just the way we are. And I don't think that it's very, I will work, do my best to create heaven on earth. But I'm not upset because earth isn't heaven, because earth is earth and heaven is heaven. And earth, as you become more conscious, you become more an instrument of moving earth towards heaven. And that's part of the perfection of it, is that process going on. At the same moment, there is also the expression of lack of consciousness in all kinds of things. And that's who we are too. And you will find that there are places, I've noticed, and I think I said that with Dan, the fact that I'm going to get into a rental car now and drive into San Francisco on fancy roads over fancy bridges and all that, that's built on the backs of other human beings in some level. If you keep following it back, we have been trying to figure out in SEVA how to do ethical investing. Well, you try. It's really tricky business. How many levels back do you go before there's somebody supporting something in Africa that you don't want to do? And it's far hard to find a company that isn't using some product or have some policy or something, and you've got to really constantly, it's a continuous, those ethical investing firms have to constantly be studying it to find our way through. And we are a collectivity of desires, fears, agitations, all of that. That's part of the predicament of getting lost into separateness. It's built into the system. Now, do you make peace with the system, or do you sit around like the guy with AIDS, holding on to the model of what non-AIDS is like? Or do you allow for the fact there is AIDS, and then work with what you got to work with, and become an instrument for the getting rid of AIDS, without denying the fact that we are what we are, and it's all right to be what we are. We are bungling along and muddling along. I hate to say it to Dan, and I know this is a no-no, and you will be upset with me for saying it, but when that show was done, which was a few years back, Dan said to me in a later dialogue we had when he really got angry at me. I mean, this was nothing compared to the later dialogues that got heavier and heavier. And we did one at Harvard Medical School where, I mean, he was like this, and he said, the next 6 months is going to be critical to the survival of the world. Well, that was 2.5 years ago. And it wasn't critical in that sense because at some level of collective consciousness, the civilization isn't going, as Emmanuel, my spook friend, said to me when they said, is the world going to end? He says, don't worry, the bell isn't going to ring so soon. School won't be out so quick. How presumptuous of humans to think they have the control to end it. I mean, do you think that Reagan's mind is the last word in power in the universe? I mean, you know, when I, you remember that story, I've told it many times, but when I did Be Here Now, this is a weird story, but when I did Be Here Now, this book Be Here Now that many of you have seen, I think, there were, my guru called me up and he said there, he showed me a number of things in the book which turned out not to be true, which I had thought were true, and he pointed out they weren't. And he said, and they were on 2 pages, and he says, now what are you going to do about it? And I said, well, we're about to do the second printing, which was 30,000. And I said, I'll certainly write to them and ask them to change it in the next printing, because he says, fine, you do that.